Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I got to pay attention to what dials I'm twisting here, because I actually increased the volume for Sean, and I haven't even introduced him yet. But it helps for me to have my volume up. So welcome back, Sean. As a reminder, we want you to make sure I apologize. I forgot I got a plug for Jerry. So we want to make sure, and Sean knows and works with Jerry. Folks, he needs help. He needs financial help to get around that state to help people start hearing the message. So if you believe we need champions for the Constitution, Jerry's your guy for this election. Out of anybody, if you're going to support any election campaigns, that's the one. Moving forward. So as I said, welcome back. So we're diving into the ratification debates, and with Pennsylvania, we're only seeing the one side. So we're not seeing, and when we get into the other ones, it'll be more relevant for me to ask, well, what do you think, you know, seeing these different debates? Because in some of the other debates, I actually mention or I actually highlight the anti-federalists. And I say this because, and why this is important, how many times do you ever hear people say the anti-federalists were right?
Never heard it.
Okay, so lots of patriots do say it, and you're going to hear it now that you, now that I've kind of primed this, because I heard it today. I hear it on a regular basis where people are throwing it out in, you know, in social media and so forth. People that, you know, I'll say they understand the Constitution better than, you know, most of the people in their, on their page, in their social network, what have you. They may know more than them. But the problem is that when you read the assertions of the anti-federalists, the anti-federalists first off said that we needed to have a Bill of Rights, and we didn't. And as a matter of fact, the Bill of Rights are problematic. They're not problematic as far as where they do something. The fact is that they've been perverted into becoming a vestige of powers instead of restrictions. In other words, the government cannot make a law respecting those things. They can't make laws of being able to, you know, search your home without a warrant. I mean, they got to go get a warrant. We might be interested in phone tapping or, you know, getting information on this person on the line, you know, going into his computer, you know, hacking him, whatever. Well, however, they're going to basically intrude into your privacy. Or I don't want to use the word privacy because that became a problem as well. But into your personal data, you know, things on your computer, your papers, you're to be secure in those things. The restriction, the Fourth Amendment, is a hard restriction that says the government cannot meddle in any of your personal stuff without a specific warrant being signed by a judge, and that warrant must say what they're looking for and where they expect it to be. So they just can't come in and say, yeah, it's somewhere in the house. And so people look at that and they go, okay, that's kind of a good law, but it's been reinterpreted. And the courts have actually looked at this as a power. The federal government looks at that as a power and go, well, you know, we don't need to, you know, be so limited. You know, if it's in the house, then that's specific enough. So they start redefining it and they start creating laws to say, you know, if it's on the street, if it's in your trash can on the street, then that's public domain. They actually start pushing the boundaries and barriers, which ended up becoming, and I forget the name of the term, and if you know, Paul hears this live, I'm going to get a text from him. I think it's the Clear Fields Doctrine. If you look something up like the Clear Fields Doctrine, it's where the government basically assumed that, you know, maybe your house is protected, but not your property. They can get onto your property and start snooping as long as it's out in the open, because it's out in the open. If you didn't secure it for privacy purposes, then, you know, then it's fair game. What? So my point is that when we look at the Bill of Rights only became important when we had to place extra measures on states that were really behaving badly. I believe we're finally at a point, and I don't think we're past that line. The reason we're not past that line is because nobody understands the powers that the states legitimately have and what they can do and what they can't do. If we can get back there, then we can actually, I'll just say, marginalize, because the Bill of Rights means nothing if we're focused on, do you have the power to do that? No, you don't. Okay, you can't do that. When we get into that paradigm, then we're no longer worried about what they're doing to us, because we already know they can't do it to us, because it's not delegated. That was the whole point, and that's why they kept on saying, in Pennsylvania, it was already brought up. Look, if they don't have the delegated powers regarding religion, they can't even, you know, include religion in a law. We just wrapped up one, what I did yesterday was I kind of talked about Blackstone and how important it is as we started migrating away from theocratic religions, or I should say theocratic governments. The original 13 states, many of them had a theocratic government. In other words, they had a direct association with the state church, which means that they kind of utilized for their legal system, they used the Bible as the supreme law of the state. Now, the U.S. Constitution was the supreme law of the land, but the U.S. Constitution had no threat to the state church and state laws. Not at all, because they couldn't go there. So as states started abandoning this relationship, they started saying, you know, maybe we need to be a free religion market. Maybe we need to institute the freedom of religion and not have a hard tie to the churches. That's okay, but here's what ended up happening. They actually went farther on that and said, we're not going to have anything to do with it, and we're not spending the money. And they basically started abandoning helping the churches contribute to what I call the compassionate services. Now, there were states that were doing this, and they were fine without it, but I do believe that the people benefit if they have a decent, if they can provide for themselves, not via government, but either through community measures, through churches, what have you, a good welfare program. You know, not one that actually enables people, but one that truly serves them so that they can become self-sufficient again. An education program, a job, you know, a job preparations, you know, program to, well, I don't have any skills. It's, you know, I'm living in this state and they've got all these things and I can't do any of that. So, okay, so they're going to teach you. They give you some skills to go do that. Those things are important. The states really benefit from that. So when the states literally just created, they did this hiatus on being involved in it, and they said, that, and we're, you know, keeping this out. What they ended up doing was they ended up stepping in into the void, because, again, the cod fishery bounties, when we get to that this year, we're going to read that they're not even to be involved in education. Well, when they started getting involved in education, that's when they poked their not just their nose, they got their head, and the body was quickly following. As soon as they started going into education and say, we're going to start providing education. Well, that right there is a compassionate service. And that's when government started. And technically, this goes back to, is it enumerated? Did the people empower them? Now, if you look at your state constitution, a lot of state constitutions do have education in it. Believe it or not, some don't. And guess why some states don't have anything regarding education, anything regarding labor, anything regarding housing and building codes, anything regarding the environment, anything regarding energy, if I didn't say that yet. I mean, there's all of these different things that we know that there's these government laws and regulations in your state, but they're not in your constitution. So, Sean, How did they get there?
I have no idea.
So every time the federal government decided to get involved in something, whether it be health care, and actually if we look at energy, it's another one, but labor. Let's look at labor, because labor was something that they started getting involved in at the turn of the century, early 1900s. And I think the Sick Chicken Act or whatever it was, and all these other things, they started saying, you know what, we need to regulate labor. The reality was they don't have the authority to regulate labor. And what Teddy Roosevelt did was he created a Department of Commerce and Labor, because he thought it was all together, and he was going to basically usurp this power to start regulating labor. Well, there was this battle between the states and the federal government, because some states were saying, well, you can't do that. So ultimately, because, you know, this takes a long time. It takes a long time for things to happen, right, for this little monster called the Department of Commerce and Labor to grow legs. And it did, because I think it was a little bit later on, those departments were severed and separated. And next thing you know, there's this Department of Labor out there that's, you know, we need power, we need power, we need power. Well, the only way they could get power is to create an amendment so that they could actually start creating laws. But they did actually create an amendment. And most people don't know this. I mean, almost in every capacity, energy, environment, all of these other things, they never tried an amendment. The one that they actually did try was in 1926 with Calvin Coolidge, because Calvin Coolidge says, we do need to do this, and he became the presidential champion of regulating labor for children under the age of 18. And so they created this amendment, and he went out and said, folks, please ratify this amendment. We need to protect the children from, you know, becoming slaves to the job or what have you. Well, the states rejected it. That's why we don't know that amendment was out there. But it was rejected. It was out there and rejected. So the question is, if the states rejected it, then how is it that they're all doing this? This goes back to, well, how did they get it into the states? When FDR decided he was going to start controlling labor, because he's the one that really put steroids in labor regulations, and it was one of the contentions between the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, you can't do this. And he said, well, you know, I think you're right. I think that you could actually stop me, or you could make it really difficult for me to be able to do this. So one thing I can do is I can work with Congress in stacking the court and changing the makeup of the court enough, because by enlarging it, I can bring in my own people to where I can have enough people on the court to agree that I can do it. What do you think about that? And the court, so they actually did their job. They just kind of silenced, and they just started approving anything and everything else that came along. And technically, they were violating their oath. They were supposed to be doing the right thing, and they didn't. But nevertheless, and Hugo Black was a huge socialist communist who was on the court. He became the chief justice, but it didn't mean that he changed the sentiments of the court. Hugo Black was the one that, I think, if you look up the Scopes trial, I think he provided the opinion on the Scopes trial, I think. But I do know that it was him that pulled out the Danbury Baptist letter from Jefferson regarding the separation of church and state, and said there needs to be a separation between church and state. I think it was during that Scopes trial, but if not, it was a little bit later. And he was the one that actually, and this is, to me, this is the beginning of a true effort by the federal government in creating what we would call the Antichrist Church. And so as I look at how they ended up getting the labor regulations in, they came with money, and they offered money to the states to say, we're creating these regulations, and we need you to enforce them, and here's money to do that. And they go, wow, you know, this is probably more than we really need. And they go, but they didn't want to say anything. So they took the money and created, you know, this labor part of the state without changing their constitution. They just created an office to interface. It's just like the Department of Transportation. They create an office that interfaces with the federal DOT, and now we're all working in sync and doing good things. And that's how it's done. It starts with money so that the state can then, because it costs money to enforce laws. It costs money to go down those paths. And so, therefore, that's how they get these things in. So when we look at the concept of focusing on whether they have the powers or not to do it, they'll never do anything if that's where we're focused. If we're only focused on, well, hey, it's at least they're not taking my guns, right? Then, you know, you're happy because that's the only thing you care about. Man, and it's a sad indictment that we've become so shallow and so self-serving over these little passions of ours instead of guarding all of our liberties and all these things that we need to do. So that kind of answers the question, how do they get in there? And this is how we have all of these different states that are applying federal laws, whether it be environmental, energy, it doesn't matter. They're applying these laws and enforcing these laws because the states were told by the federal government and paid to do it. Did the anti-federalists warn us of that? Well, I think they did warn us of that, but the response was, well, that would be a violation and the states would need to hold them accountable. Because there's enough responses back by the federalists to say, yes, that would cause alarm in any state, in all the states, and the people should be caused, you know, this would be cause for the people to be alarmed and say, hey, we got to stop this. They don't have the authority to do that. That didn't happen. And the anti-federalists, I don't know if they were just really more interested or people were more interested in proving that the anti-federalists were right instead of doing what the right thing was and say, hey, you don't have this authority. So as nice as it is that you build this nice freeway coming through our state to help us move commerce, you don't have that authority. Go get an amendment or let us do this and you quit taking our money, because really what's happening is they've been overspending and they're overtaxing. So what do they do with the next extra bundle of money that they get because they're overtaxing? This goes back to the concept of why the 16th Amendment was actually put into play. Wilson wanted to have this ability to overtax, and in so doing, because if they can get away with overtaxing, then they can take that money that they've got in their hands and spend it. And once they start spending it and throwing, you know, the fats and, you know, the trimmings out to the states and the people will love it, just like Caesar. And that's true. And nobody was caring that they were spending money that they didn't have. And it just became this huge bad cycle of taxing more to spend more, taxing more to spend. This is why there's constantly been this growth of government, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Historically, it makes sense that that's the way it happened, but it doesn't make sense.
Okay. I don't know how to respond to that.
It doesn't make sense that we would allow them to do that.
You know, the people have this blind faith. They have blind faith in the party. They have blind faith in their public servants. And so the people have to put guards and checks in. And unless you have guards and checks, this is why these constitutional compliance committees at the county level is, I believe, the beginning of the people actually saying, we want to make sure everything is in compliance. And by doing that, that changes everything, because now there's a term I think Madison used, or maybe Hamilton, about this discerning eye, you know, this surgical eye of looking and seeking out these things. Now that they're looking, then they can actually contain and stop these things from increasing, and actually stopping from them continuing to where we can undo them. But until we actually, we the people have to do it. And it kind of goes that paradigm of nothing's going to get anything done unless you do it yourself. You want dinner? You either got to go out and buy, you know, go somewhere else, pay somebody to make it for you, make it yourself. I mean, it ain't going to happen unless you do something. And so
I think it goes along with the scriptures and with that lovely quote. I love it so much. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. It's just like your spiritual life. You have to constantly nurture it. You can't just say, okay, I'm free and I have a government with these checks and balances, so I'm just going to go about my way and not worry about it and hope that everything works out. Because with the nature of man in this fallen world, there's going to be corruption. There's going to be people who are drawn to that power to use it for nefarious purposes that erode your liberty. So we have to be vigilant.
Yes. And actually, those are the things that, that you know, Hamilton and Madison in the Federalist Papers stated, and even in the ratification debates, the Federalists were saying, you got to be vigilant. This is what you got to do. So you're going to see these things. You're going to read these things. So, you know, without any further ado, let's now dive into this next comment regarding sovereignty and supreme, or this government that's being created has the supremacy, but the supremacy is contingent upon the powers that it has. It is not supreme in all things. It's only supreme in those things granted. So let's go ahead and start off with this Declaration of Independence recap right here. Go ahead.
Well, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. End quote. This is the broad basis on which our independence was placed. On the same certain and solid foundation, this system is erected. State sovereignty, as it is called, is far from being able to support its weight. Nothing less than the authority of the people could either support it or give it efficacy. I cannot pass over this subject without noticing the different conduct pursued by the late Federal Convention and that observed by the convention which framed the Constitution of Pennsylvania. On that occasion, you find an attempt made to deprive the people of this right, so lately and so expressly asserted in the Declaration of Independence. We are told in the preamble to the Declaration of Rights and Frame of Government that we, quote, do by virtue of the authority vested in us, ordain, declare, and establish the following Declaration of Rights and Frame of Government to be the Constitution of this Commonwealth and to remain in force therein mattered, except in such articles as shall hereafter, on experience, be found to require improvement, and which shall by the same authority of the people, fairly delegated as this frame of government directs. End quote. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Chambers, was well warranted in saying that all could be done was done, all that could be done was done, to cut off the people from the right of amending, for it cannot be amended by any other mode than that which it directs. Then any number of more than one-third may control any number less than two-thirds.
Okay, so right there, let's just stop right there, because as you can see, we're going into a break. Okay, so it's interesting how, you know, the different ways we're going to find these assertions regarding, you know, this new Constitution. But let's get through the break here. That way we can kind of dive into... Yeah, or finish this and then kind of dive into this Constitution of its what it is supreme over and the cause and alarm that it is not supreme over all things, where in some ways and aspects, you know, well, I don't have time. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're just kind of taking a pause. I don't necessarily, because he's kind of setting things up. He's using some quotes and so forth. One of the things that's kind of interesting is that right now we as a nation have been driven into a democracy. And I say that because there was no way that our government has the ability to take money from those who have and give it to those who have not. That is not a power granted, but we're doing it. And we've done it so much, we've created an entitlement state, the state of entitlement. And if you kind of understand, this is how they have perverted our government. Because when you read and look at the Constitution was a perfect security against Alexander Teitler's cycle of democracy. Are you familiar with that term?
I've heard it. Okay. I don't really know a lot about it.
Okay. So Alexander Teitler's cycle of democracy is a 200-year cycle. That when a government is formed, it's kind of formed and kind of limited in general fashion, but there's not limited like our Constitution, and it does really good things. And over time, government starts creating favors. They start creating benefits of helping people. And the more benefits, the more people go, we want more. And ultimately, what ends up happening is the amount of takers exceed the amount of makers, or exceed the amount that the makers can make, to where it busts the system, that after 200 years, it usually runs its course to where a government literally collapses under its own weight, because it falls into this cycle of allowing government to start doing noble things by giving things to people when it shouldn't, and ending up basically entitling everybody to have something to where, and this, this has happened, and this has been put on steroids. When you go into socialism and communism, that's very much what we're talking about. And Otto von Bismarck in Germany in the late 1800s created a socialist government without really going through the full buy-in. People really didn't know. It sounded good. And there were economists like Ludwig von Mises later on, who basically said that was the stupidest thing he could have done. But he created this thing called Social Security. And what would happen is that people would be able to retire when they wanted to retire, and everybody would be paying into it. The premise was that most people would be honorable, and they wouldn't game the system and jump out early and put a greater drain on society and other people to, pay. And what ended up happening, this happened in Italy too. This has happened throughout Europe, where this entitlement state, this is why we've seen the insolvency of, I think, Spain, Italy, but this happened in the late 1800s, where socialism literally went amok. And other governments in Europe have basically gone down that same path. They found a different way to get there, but ultimately they bankrupted themselves because they got to a point where there wasn't enough money to be made and people weren't making enough to be able to pay for those who demanded, hey, where's my retirement? Where's my money? And people were, and now that they didn't have jobs, guess what? They're out in the streets burning things. It really backfired. And so what ended up happening with Otto von Bismarck, if you look the story up, it's kind of interesting, because he set the stage for World War I. Because Germany was so economically impacted, it was such an adverse impact on Germany, that they had problems trying to, you know, feed themselves and trying to basically pull themselves up from their bootstraps. There were reasons behind that. There were corporate banking reasons and so forth that kind of helped draw and push. I'm not going to say that there wasn't, you know, this conspiracy. There was. There were powers that were literally making these things happen. But what Otto von Bismarck did, I don't think his, it was his plan to actually do what happened. And I think he was dumbfounded. I think he was basically bamboozled into, you know, buying into this strategy. But bottom line, the Titler cycle of democracy and these types of things literally, you know, collapse us. We the people have to be very guarded in understanding where we have to maintain limited government. I see today all sorts of things where democracy is being embraced and we're turning our back on true republicanism and true limited government. Yeah, it's nice to be able to turn around and say the consequences of my stupid decision can be, you know, minimized or wiped away when government can step in and just rebuild me because I chose to live right here on this little beachfront property and they're going to come in and repair, you know, my home or what have you because of a storm. Well, they never have that authority to do that. And people that make those decisions, they either lose their home if there's no way of you know, giving to you, you know, a, what do you want to call that, a pass or, you know, a free card. So, okay, you know, we're all going to come in and because we love you, we're just going to give you your home back. We're going to rebuild that home for you so you can stay right there and that really nice property. I mean, this is
like
just
the Amish did in Virginia or West Virginia. Well, in North Carolina.
Well, so the Amish actually do take care of their own. There's nothing wrong with that. Right. But I'm talking about when you know you're going to build, the storm wave action on this coastline, you know, hits every 3, 5, 10 years, whatever it is. There's these cycles. And if you build a house that will not withstand that wave storm action, then whose fault is it? If you don't do
it, it's yours.
There you go.
Built it.
There you go. And it's one thing if it's a community, if the Amish go in there. But I'm going to tell you, if the Amish go in there, they're not going to be making dumb decisions. They're going to build houses that will withstand the weather. That will, you know,
exactly, yeah.
So that's the point. When we have government that steps in, you know, and actually just wipes out, you know, okay, you get a do-over. Just because you lived here and, you know, so many people have been so adversely affected, you know, you now qualify for this big federal umbrella of, you know, love, you know, this package of love. I'm going, they shouldn't even be doing that. They shouldn't do that. But that's where we are, where we're doing such great things and giving and more and more enabling people to continue staying and where they're staying so they can continually drain us when the next storm comes. So this all basically lays out that the Constitution was a secure safeguard from our government going down that path because it was limited and defined. But the Bill of Rights created this focus on that they can't do this instead of everybody looking and going, what can they do? Can they do that? Can they do this? So this goes back to this whole concept. I think what he's trying to say here is that regardless of the sovereignty that your state has or doesn't have at the time, those things will change. When all of a sudden people start becoming more willing to surrender more security for or more liberties for security. Well, do I care if I have to do that myself? If I have government do that, then that's what we start doing. And Benjamin Franklin talked about, you know, surrendering liberty for security. If the government can, you know, basically give you, you know, anything and everything, then the government can take from you anything and everything. So the Constitution kept that from happening. That's the whole point here. That's all this whole waste of air and airtime. The Constitution did not allow this to actually go down that path. This sovereignty was very limited and defined. And I think what he's trying to do here, because he's talking about the state sovereignty, and so forth. We, the people, are the problem. We're the problem. Our representatives are the problem. Because if we're not sticking to, you know, functioning government the way government's supposed to function, I don't know. It's kind of like using a computer for something that a computer's not designed for. You know, like, you know, the CD tray as a coffee cup holder, right? I mean, you might may have heard in when those things came out, hey, it's a coffee cup holder. Look at that.
It is now.
And so, whoop, and then they broke it. And then somebody comes along and says, hey, you know, you need to install this with this. Well, that's not working. Why? Well, because you use it as a coffee cup holder. Anyway, I apologize for going on. What I wanted to kind of help clarify is, you know, he's trying to help people understand that this is an ultimate and absolute sovereignty over those few things delegated, where in the state, it's kind of the same thing. But their state and their constitutions weren't the same as this federal constitution. So anyway, I will yield. Go ahead and let's finish the rest of this highlighted part here. Go ahead.
Alrighty, sir. But I return to my general reasoning. My position is, sir, that in this country, the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable power resides in the people at large, that they have vested certain proportions of this power in the state governments, but that the fee simple continues, resides, and remains with the body of the people. Under the practical influence of this great truth, we are now sitting and deliberating, and under its operation, we can sit as calmly and deliberate as coolly in order to change the Constitution as a legislature can sit and deliberate under the power of a Constitution in order to alter or amend the law. It is true the exercise of this power will not probably be so frequent, nor resorted to on so many occasions in one case as in the other, but the recognition of the principle cannot fail to establish it more firmly. But because this recognition is made in the proposed Constitution, an exception is taken to the whole of it. For we are told it is a violation of the present Confederation, a confederation of sovereign states. I shall not enter into an investigation of the present Confederation, but shall just remark that its principle is not the principle of free governments. The people of the United States are not, as such, represented in the present Congress, and considered even as a component parts of the several states. They are not represented in proportion to their numbers and importance.
Ah, and so right there he's kind of laying out that in the Republican form of government in Congress, it's more of a magistrate, and it's the government or the legislatures that are in control. But bottom line, his argument and his position, because I think I mentioned this a few days ago when we kind of talked about Pennsylvania and Wilson. Wilson's this big, you know, he's a big proponent of we the people, that the power resides in the people. Absolutely. And so the people can allow their government to be destroyed at their own hands because they want, you know, free food, because they want, you know, to work less and get more money out of their, you know, more money out of their labor efforts so they get paid more, minimum wage, those types of things. So we can create more and more entitlements and more and more until we break the camel's back. And so I think that this is a lesson that it's really hard to get your arms around, but Tytler's cycle of democracy, I think, really kind of helps people start understanding that the way the Constitution was done, there's no way we could go down that path. As long as we, the people, You know, when we bought into this Constitution, we held it based on this limited and defined government without the Bill of Rights. I'm at a point now where I honestly think if a state wants to have their own Bill of Rights, they can. But I honestly think that the states need to go to very limited and defined constitutions where the power is delegated, specific power is delegated, and that's it. We need to model our state constitutions more like the federal constitution so that they can't just do everything. So that when they start doing something, they go, hold on, where did you get the authority to do it? Well, the federal government. Well, we don't care. The federal government doesn't have the authority to do that. And that's how we start finding out that the federal government's doing things we didn't even know. We didn't give them the authority to control the environment, so forth and so on. So let's move on to the next one, because now he talks about representation. This is a short one. Go ahead.
I say, sir, that it was the design of this system to take some power from the state government and to place it in the general government. It was also the design that the people should be admitted to the exercise of some powers, which they did not exercise under the present federation. It was thought proper that the citizens, as well as the states, should be represented. How far the representation in the Senate is a representation of states, we shall see by and by when we come to consider that branch of the federal government.
Right. Okay. So,
prophecy.
So, again, he's talking about these separate representations, that the Senate's representing the state legislature. In other words, they maintained that part of the Articles of Confederation, this equality, because the states were equal, regardless of their population. Now, in Congress, when it came to going to war, when it came to some of these things, taxes and so forth, because the people were being represented, this is where the people could actually, you know, ensure that, you know, they could have or not have. And this became the crux of where we, because of our illiteracy, and we, because of, you know, I'll just say machinations and nefarious men, you know, basically laid out a plan to convince good people to adopt bad ideas. Minimum wage, anything like that, where government is regulating those types of things that they shouldn't be regulating. We're far better off having a free system than we are having a heavily regulated system, you know, almost every way that we can think of. But there are things that do require regulations. When you, if you had a free roadway where there was no lines on the road, that would make life really interesting. And everybody, you know, if they could make up their own rules, and shoot, when they were driving, they had this printed rule book, and this is how I'm driving. If they were able to do that, how chaotic would things be?
Very. Absolutely. It's already chaotic, and they have rules.
Correct. I get it. So, in ways, we do surrender our freedom in the way we want to express our driving, but in other ways, anyway, and I can easily, it's a great example, and I don't want to take a lot of time because I want to make sure we try to get through at least this part of the day. Let's do the jurisdiction next now. Another short one.
Sure. Do we wish to a return of those insurrections and tumults to which a sister state was lately exposed, or a government of such insufficiency as the present is found to be? Let me, sir, mention one circumstance in the recollection of every honorable gentleman who hears me. To the determination of Congress are submitted all disputes between states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or right of soil. In consequence of this power, after much altercation, expense of time, and considerable expense of money, this state was successful enough to obtain a decree in her favor, in a difference then subsisting between her and Connecticut. But what was the consequence? The Congress had no power to carry the decree into execution, hence the distraction and animosity which have ever since prevailed and still continue in that part of the country. Ought the government then to remain any longer incomplete? I hope not. No person can be so insensible to the lessons of experience as to desire it.
Okay, so interesting point. How it again, the Articles of Confederation created a impotent and inept government. It was incapable and had no power to do anything that it wanted to do, that even its Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, told it to do. So let's go into commerce. Go ahead.
No man is obliged to consume more than he pleases, and each buys in proportion only to his consumption. The price of the commodity is blended with the tax, and the person is often not sensible of the payment. But would it have been proper to rest the matter there? Suppose this fund should not prove sufficient. Ought the public debts to remain unpaid, or the exigencies of government be left unprovided for? Should our tranquility be exposed to assaults of foreign enemies or violence among ourselves because the objects of commerce may not furnish a sufficient revenue to secure them all? Certainly Congress should possess the power of raising revenue from their constituents for the purpose mentioned in the 8th section of the first article, and that is, quote, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, end quote. It has been common with the gentlemen on this subject to present us with frightful pictures. We are told of the hosts of tax gatherers that will swarm through the land, and whenever taxes are mentioned, military force seems to be an attending idea. I think I may venture to predict that the taxes of the general government, if any shall be laid, will be more equitable and much less expensive than those imposed by state governments.
Okay. Interesting, and well, I think he may have been a little bit wrong, because the Assumption Act started, you know, the ball rolling as far as taxation, and nobody saw the Assumption Act. I mean, it was kind of talked about. We're going through Madison's notes, which we just recently did. We kind of looked that there was this, you know, talking about assuming the debt, but they never did, and it wasn't put in for them to be able to do that. Let's go into the Necessary and Proper Clause. Go ahead.
It is urged as a general objection to the system that, quote, the powers of Congress are unlimited and undefined, and that they will be the judges in all cases of what is necessary and proper for them to do, end quote. To bring this subject to your view, I need no more than point to the words in the Constitution, beginning at the 8th section, Article 1st, quote, the Congress, it says, shall have power, end quote, etc. And I need not read over the words, but I leave it to every gentleman to say whether the powers are not as accurately and minutely defined as can be well done on the same subject in the same language. The old Constitution is as strongly marked on this subject, and even the concluding clause, with which so much fault has been found, gives no more or other powers, nor does it in any degree go beyond the particular enumeration. For when it is said that the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper, those words are limited and denned by the following, quote, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, end quote. It is saying no more than the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectively carried into execution. And he sounds like GR.
And you know what? What you just read, we're going to hear so many other people in the different debates saying the exact same thing. And why is it that, and the reality, they literally started because the judiciary and Hamilton, as you know, giving them the Federalist Papers, they assumed powers that they didn't have. And by doing so, that's when they actually started allowing these interpretations of laws, implied powers, and these types of things. So anyway, yes. Yeah. So actually, I sound like Wilson. I sound like Madison. I sound like these guys. Yeah. Because that's what they say all the time. And you'll say it too, because you're reading these things. Okay, so here's commerce.
The letter which accompanies this Constitution must strike every person with the utmost force. Quote, the friends of our country have long seen and desired that the power of war, peace, and treaties that of levying money and regulating commerce, and the corresponding executive and judicial authorities should be fully and effectually vested in the general government of the Union. But the impropriety of delegating such extensive trust to one body of men is evident. Hence results the necessity of a different organization. End quote.
Okay. There we go. Now, the one thing, because, and I point this out, most of the anti-federalists didn't get their knickers in a bunch because, oh, I'm looking at the Commerce Clause, and they're going to regulate every aspect of commerce. When we go through the ratification base, we'll find that when everybody reads the words, regulate commerce among the states, nobody ever saw that. Nobody even said that means that we can come in and regulate everything you build, everything you buy, blah, 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 blah. No. Nobody saw it differently. It took time, and I would say magical mushrooms and peyote tea, to where the visionary oracles could say, wow, we now can see things differently. And that's when they started really describing that the Commerce Clause gave the federal government the ability to come into every state. But the point is this is one of the very few, you know, I highlight them. And you're going to realize that the debate and what they're talking about regarding commerce really was not trying to defend the fact. Very rarely was there any assertion made that the federal government was going to come in and actually tell you how to, you know, grow your turnips and determine what kind of energy you were going to use to, you know, to manufacture this or and so forth and so on. They had no authority to regulate your commerce, period. And this is why it's not that there weren't comments regarding commerce, but the comments that were being made did not lend to any concern that they were afraid that the federal government was going to try to do that. That's how crazy the Commerce Clause had become, because the delusional courts, or I should say, you know, the stuff that they were smoking, you know, really took them down this real wild ride to say, yeah, let's do that, and bypass among the states and say, in the states, we can regulate commerce anywhere and everywhere, because we said so. Anyway, yeah, Hamilton, boy, he screw things up. Okay, so now we're going to go to the next section, same day, but this is one on slavery. And if you notice, this is a long one, so we'll actually cover this when we come back because, again, this is long. Any saved rounds because we're basically out of time?
No, sir.
Okay, all right. Well, as we continue doing this, even though the repetition, and it's literally somebody else saying something same but different, if we don't do this, then people will not obtain this understanding of the magnitude of how clear these issues were brought up, how clear they made that these powers were very defined, that this is what these things meant. And yet, still today, they get reinterpreted and redefined ad nauseum. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.